Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shops, the Spectator's political podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast and I'm joined today by Fraser Nelson and Katie Balls. So, James Brokenshire, the Housing Secretary, is going to be unveiling the government's new £100 million strategy to tackle homelessness. Katie, what are we expecting to see in it?
So this is part of the government's social housing green paper, which, like lots of things in government, has been delayed, but has finally arrived to keep us, I think, distracted from other things during the long summer recess. One of the big thing they're pushing the most is this £100 million fund to eradicate homelessness, Marini. I mean, homelessness has been rising for the past 7 years, so I think to eradicate it seems like quite a high goal. We've had a junior minister say if they don't meet their target, they would consider leaving. I think James Brokenshire has stopped short of promising to resign if they don't eradicate it. But yeah, it would be interesting to see. I mean, in terms of like actual sums, it's not that large a sum for what has actually become a much bigger problem in recent years.
I think this is a classic case of government giving this really spectacular goal, you know, the elimination of homelessness. You show me a country in the world that has genuinely eliminated homelessness to cover up for the lack of strategy. And I'm struck by just how little there diagnosis there is. Why has it been rising? What are the causes behind it? Now, a large part of that will be immigration, because we've certainly seen people, you know, coming here to operate as professional beggars. That's an aspect, not a big part of it, but still significant. But the wider problem, I think, is the cutback in support for mental health provision in local authorities and other places. I think a lot of people are on the streets because they have drug problems and they need support, which they're not getting. That support has been cut over the years by, in my view, wrong-headed conservative decisions. And this is having a far more important backlash. Now, there's no point saying you're going to deal with the problem with 100 million quid if you're not really going to address some of the deeper causes of this. So I would be, today's announcement makes me think back to when the Conservatives used to, under David Cameron, have a far more holistic approach to this and would talk about the pathways to poverty, about the effect of mental health. And unless they actually work out that they've gone too far with the mental health cuts, I don't think they're going to eradicate homelessness in 10 years or any period of time at all.
Another person who's got a view on housing is Boris Johnson. Last week he used his column to talk about the burqa. This week he's talking about stamp duty and that the fact should be abolished. Fraser, are we starting to get a sense of a kind of Boris manifesto?
Well, I think that yet again, Boris's enemies have played straight into his hands. The last week, I mean, I've been away in Sweden for 3 weeks, but even in Sweden, I picked up the newspapers and was reading about letterboxes and bank robbers and Boris. And this was a fuss created not so much by Boris, but by the members of the government who were outraged by his message and therefore amplified it to an exponential degree. And the story became not so much what he wrote in the newspaper, but how the rest of his party was behaving to it. As a result, you've created a massive audience for his next column. You had, you know, television cameras outside Boris's house, seeing him come out of his minicab from the airport back home, writing his column. And what does he have to say? Housing policy. So he's giving his alternative manifesto. I have to say it's a bit more convincing than the government's one right now. He's talking about the need to cut stamp duty in London and in cut taxes in general. So we're beginning to see the outline of a Boris manifesto. He is somebody who, first of all, is taking the housing crisis very seriously, expressing it in vivid terms, talking, as he always does, through the example of people who he met, and then giving the Boris solution, which is a very conservative solution, which is to crack down on cartels and to lower taxes.
Katie, do you think we're going to be spending the week talking about Boris's ideas rather than Theresa May's government ideas?
I don't think this is going to take off in quite the same way as the burqa article did last week, but I think a combination of talking about housing this week, which will feed into Boris's views, and the burqa rise still rumbling on, means that Boris is still going to get a decent amount of press coverage this week compared to Theresa May. I think what's quite tricky for the government here is everyone's calling out for a radical housing agenda, and it's obviously only one article, so you don't have to go through on your promises as such, or, you know, meet different lobbies to see what they think of it. But it does sound more radical than the government's plan at the moment to get rid of stamp duty. And obviously, at the moment, we have stamp duty for first-time buyers that's been cut down. But this is taking that, you know, to another level, and it's something that I don't think the government are even going to try and compete with in terms of risk.
Another important dividing line that Boris has drawn with Theresa May's government is that his instinct is to cut taxes, where hers is to increase them. Now, whatever Philip Hammond has got in store in his next budget, it will involve increasing the tax burden already at a 30-year high. A lot of Conservatives are really fed up with this. They ask, what's the point of backing a Conservative government if it's going to take taxes higher and higher and higher? Now, remember, all of this row through the burqa, through housing, through everything, is being done through the prism of the next leadership debate, whenever that's going to come. And we can begin to see the Boris manifesto. The fuss created for him by his critics has established him yet again as a front-runner, perhaps not the front-runner, but maybe number two, as Katie and Paul Staines were saying in last week's podcast. But he can now articulate his vision of conservatism, and it is off a smaller government taking less of other people's money. So it wouldn't surprise me if Boris builds up steadily a little Boris manifesto through his columns, guaranteed an audience by people who are trying to crush him. In fact, they're doing the exact reverse.
And you can also see the effect Boris is having, because you can see people trying to latch on to that impact. So you had, I think you get the story about once every 5 months, which is David Davis, caretaker prime minister. It's always a friend of David. I might be the same friend every time. But they found a new peg for it this week in the Mail on Sunday, which is basically that, look, Boris would definitely win if he went to the polls. Boris Johnson is a great guy. All the Tory members love Boris Johnson. You know who's also great? David Davis. And if you didn't want the full time a Tory leadership contest would take, so the fact that, you know, 6 weeks longer to sort that out while the Brexit negotiations were going on, everyone could just agree to put David Davis up for it because he's approaching 70. He promises he wouldn't stay as welcome, and then he'll step away aside and make the way for Boris Johnson, which, I mean, I've read it with some amusement, partly just because it's interesting how an old story is managing to change in a way because of how the leadership race has changed, and so has other people's pictures.
I have to say, it's a bit of a funny argument saying that if you're 70, that means you're going to cork it. And I was looking at the other day at Donald Trump. He's now has got a secure number of advisors around him. He's not at war with his advisors anymore. But they're all in their late 60s and early 70s. His chief of staff, his national security advisor. So, you know, I think the day of a late 60s, 70-year-old politician might be coming. Maybe David Davis can come back and break this grey ceiling of ours.
Well, we'll have to wait to see what Boris writes about next week. And finally, we've got this new research out which shows that Theresa May's soft Brexit plan would put 25 Tory seats at risk. Fraser, do you think this is going to worry the Tories?
Oh, it should terrify the Tories. She never expected the public reaction to this. And there's a big question, what counts as a betrayal of Brexit? Now, personally, I wouldn't regard a Chequers plan as a betrayal of Brexit. I think we'd still be leaving the EU, we'd still be getting control over the borders. But that's not how people at large see it. The opinion polls are really quite striking in that your average Brexit voter might not have studied every dot and comma of the Chequers plan, but has already decided that it's a sellout. Now, what do these guys do if a Tory party sell out their Brexit? The answer is that they will vote for UKIP as they did before, and of course it will cost the Conservatives lots of seats. In the same way that winning seats back from UKIP took Cameron to a majority government in 2015, you can very easily see how if they come up with what is seen as a betrayal of Brexit, even though it wouldn't really be, well, certainly not in my eyes, that could put them out of power.
Do you think that they could also win seats if they have a soft Brexit?
No, I don't think anybody who's against Brexit is really going to thank the Tories for coming up with a softer version of it. I think that's the other funny thing about the Chequers plan. It was completely attacked by those who wanted what some might call a full-blooded Brexit. But the Remainers saying, oh, look at this, this is the worst of both worlds, it's terrible. So I really couldn't see where the political capital comes from the Chequers plan.
And I think in this research by Matthew Goodman, he makes the point that the problem is that even some Conservative MPs don't accept this, but they're a long way from the 2015 election in terms of who they're appealing to now. It's much more kind of blue-collar voters, and that means that if they start to lose Brexit voters, they're in a lot more trouble. I do think what's also funny this summer is one of the many themes is poll wars. So on Friday, we had a poll that put the Tories back ahead, and that was quickly, you know, put out and tweeted by lots of Theresa May's supporters, you know, people involved in Number 10. We had Gavin Barwell previously, you know, tweeting up polls where the Tories are neck and neck with Labour, which shows you where we are really. And then whenever we've had one where Labour have, you know, gone ahead or the Tories have lost points, lots of people like Stuart Jackson, David Davis's former special advisor, and actually just Tory MPs who are Brexiteers have been quick to tweet them. So I've noticed this research today has been widely shared online by Tory Brexiteers who obviously want to make this point that this is why the Prime Minister should change course. And I actually think in a way they were hoping that as time goes it would become more dramatic because that is more likely to make Number 10 rethink it. Whereas I think at the moment what's tricky is Friday's poll and things does show it's kind of the going back and forth in terms of what voters think, but obviously there's more factors than just Brexit here.
I think public opinion is still very volatile in Britain, as it is pretty much all over Europe. When I was in Sweden, I was covering their elections, which are coming up in a few weeks' time. And the big story there is the populist Sweden Democrats, who look like they might well finish first in the election. And it's a bit of a puzzle. Why is it that, you know, stable Sweden and most of Europe are haunted by these populist parties, where in Britain, we don't have populist parties in Parliament. We've got hardly any. I mean, sure, UKIP's now doing a bit better than the 2% they used to get, but they're not really anywhere. And the answer is because Brexit was the device by which disgruntled voters tugged government back towards them. Now, if they think they're not going to get this Brexit, then I think the polls would mean nothing, and you could very quickly get a movement of a populist party back in Britain. And what we've learned, not just in Britain, but all over Europe over the last 3 or 4 years, is how parties can come from nowhere to finish second, even to finish in government, if the politicians think they can not respond to people's concerns. So it might be, in parliamentary terms, possible for the Tories to welsh on the Brexit commitments. But if people who voted for Brexit see that happening, I think things could change very, very quickly. And the Tories won't be worrying about a one-point lead or being even with Labour. They could have their support fracture quite quickly. So I think it's, you know, Brexit might not be going very well as far as negotiations are concerned, but the idea that you can somehow pull the plug on the project would be to invite the spectre of populism to come haunting Britain in the same way as haunting Europe.
Thank you, Fraser, and thank you, Katie. And just a reminder that this podcast is called Coffee House Shots. If you like it, please do let us know. We always like to hear from you. And we've also got an event coming up, Ruth Davidson in conversation with Andrew Neil. It's on the 24th of September in Westminster. And if you'd like to get a free ticket to this event, you can get one if you take out a subscription to The Spectator. Just go to spectator.co.uk/Davidson to find out more information. Thanks for listening.